Many of you would be very familiar with the voice you're hearing now. Michael Burgess joins us today on the Drew Marshall Show. And, I mean, if you've not heard this gentleman's voice, you're missing out on life, really. That's kind of the bottom line. Whether before Queen Elizabeth or Mikhail Gorbachev, Michael's pure tenor voice has melted the hearts of thousands around the world. But maybe none so much as during his breathtaking performance in the hit musical Les Mis. I want you to welcome Michael Burgess to the show. Michael, good to have you.
Nice to be here, Drew. Thanks.
How's the traffic out there?
The traffic's pretty heavy.
You came?
Yeah, I had to cut it pretty close.
Did you?
I got here, yeah, but I was a little surprised. I just absolutely stopped on the Queen Elizabeth. So,
yeah.
But you forget what it's like.
Exactly. Well, I live out in the sticks, and every time I come down here, I think, oh, you know, how can anybody handle this kind of driving?
It's well, crazy. You just do.
Yeah, you just put up with it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for being here. I know your schedule is very, very busy, and it took us a while to kind of get you in here.
Yeah,
but,
I've been looking forward to it.
You're all over the place. You're everywhere.
Yeah, well, I'm paying the bills and keeping busy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we all know what that's like.
Yeah.
Do you think when people think Michael Burgess, the first thing that comes to mind is Les Mis, or is it something else?
I think for a lot of people, it is Les Mis people, certainly people who have seen it, but, you know, I'm under no illusions. It's the theater, and, although we ran for 3.5 years, you know, and it reached a brand new audience, which, I don't think a theater piece in Canada had done before that. So, but there's still a lot of people who never saw it. So, I think it's Les Mis, and I think it's a lot of things, whether it be, you know, the national anthem or a lot of television shows I've done or Ants in Your Pants on YTV. And, you know, I meet more people who say to me, hey, my kids watch you all the time on the comfy couch.
You are, a man of many talents, obviously, and I just want to bring people up to speed on a few of these things. The 10th anniversary concert at Royal Albert Hall in London, England. I want you to tell me about that experience.
That was pretty spectacular. First of all, I was really honored to be invited and to represent the Canadian production, and we had a lot of people in the cast who were really, really wonderful. So it was really an honor for me, and to be there. You know, all those Valjeans all from all over the world, it was really incredible. It was like a reunion of having played for the Toronto Maple Leafs or the Montreal Canadiens. I imagine in my mind that's what it would be like, you know, if you had been a part of a Stanley Cup winning team or something. And maybe that's just me, but that's what I thought about. It was really wonderful. The place was full. The evening was spectacular. And the audience, there was like 5,000 people there at Royal Albert Hall. They did not know that this was going to happen at the end, that this big celebration of all the Valjeans from all over the world were going to be there. So they were just totally surprised. And, you know, we all shared lines of one of the songs from Les Mis, It's a very emotional experience. I'll never forget it, along with so many other experiences associated with Les Miserables.
Sure, sure. Tell me about David Cassidy.
David Cassidy was great. I mean, he and I got along very, very well right off the top. And
in Blood Brothers, of course.
In Blood Brothers, yeah. And he was very, very professional, very conscientious actor. And
he doesn't still have the mullet haircut, does he? I mean,
No. No. Thank goodness. And that's the way he feels too.
Yeah, that's right.
But we had a wonderful time together, and we ate at restaurants here every day together, and hung out, and it was great. It was great doing the show. It was a wonderful piece.
Man of La Mancha. How long was your experience with that?
Man of La Mancha. We opened in Edmonton with Robin Phillips.
Right.
Man of La Mancha is interesting because, after doing Les Miserables for 3.5 years, I really thought I would never work again. Because, you know, like...
Were you wiped after that? Were you just
Okay. No, not at all. But I didn't know what could be next. You know, like, first of all, when you're involved with a long-running show like that, your career is stopped. You mean, you're doing what you're doing, but you're not available for much
else. Anything
else,
no, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So people don't, you know, think about you that way. Oh, yeah, he's busy.
Right.
So when it's over, and it's also over suddenly, you know, I mean, even though you know it's coming, it's just over one night. So I just didn't know what I was going to do. Although the day after it was finished, I flew to Barcelona, Spain, and participated in the opening of the Olympics there, which was absolutely, again, fabulous to do. But when I came back home, I just kind of thought, well, I don't know what's next, so I guess we just take a breather, try and reflect on everything that's happened, and move ahead. Then Robin Phillips called me and asked me if I would like to do Man of La Mancha, which I thought for about half a second, yeah, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went from doing Victor Hugo to doing another great work of literature, Cervantes, of Don Quixote. So I was really, really lucky, and in many ways, you know, two great, great roles of the musical theater, Jean Valjean and Don Quixote. So it was...
Which role did you resonate with the most?
Both of them, for different
really?
Reasons.
Yeah,
for very different reasons. They represent different psychological studies as an actor. You know, Les Miserables, the story, morally, I mean, people get it immediately that this man has been not fairly treated, for put in jail for 18 years for stealing a loaf of bread. That's not right.
Yeah.
So therefore, you then have to deal with the results of that, the ramifications, the problems that he had dealing with that. People go, wow, if that were me, I can understand why a person would be angry, you know. And with Don Quixote, you know, that wonderful image of this crazy man running at windmills, thinking that they're dragons, you know, and they have to be defeated. You know, the wonderful thing, the wonderful theatrical thing about Man of La Mancha is that it's a play within a play. It takes place during the Spanish Inquisition, another horrendous time in human history, as with the streets of Paris, with Les Miserables. But the Spanish Inquisition was just an awful time, where people were murdered and killed, and this author is thrown into a dungeon with a bunch of murderers and thieves. And in the end, he makes them believe in something. He gives them hope, by telling them this story of this crazy man. And they become a part of it, and they start to believe in it. So when he dies as Don Quixote, not as Cervantes, they are very, very moved by this. And so when the Inquisition calls for Cervantes to come up to trial, they are sending all their thoughts with him. It's a whole new level has come into the play.
Now, maybe it's just me, but it seems like everybody resonates with hope.
Absolutely.
Right?
And both of those plays are about hope,
yeah,
in different ways,
yeah,
for different reasons. Both of them are just as powerful.
Tell me about Stratford. My recollection of Stratford is,
yeah,
school trips,
yeah,
long, boring bus rides,
yeah,
someone throwing up in the bus, inevitably, and horrible lunches,
yeah,
and someone playing King who would it be? King Lear?
King Richard? King Lear?
I think it was a King Lear who used to spit on the first five rows of people. He was so into his acting and his, it was just, you know what I mean? Do you know, there's specifically one guy who used to just salivate over the first five rows.
I don't know. I've seen it happen. Oh,
people brought rain jackets like they were seeing a performance of Gallagher in his Sledge-O-Matic.
No, Stratford, you know, I mean, Stratford is a magnificent place of theater with a great, great history. My experience with Stratford was extraordinary for me. I did both Shakespearean and other plays there. I did Jean Gascon's last production there, which was La Vie Parisienne, which was with a wonderful cast and great, great fun. And Stratford is a very, very special place. When I was a kid growing up and when I started to do theater, I mean, that's where I wanted to go. I wanted to be at Stratford. Mind you, when I was first there, I was doing a production of Pinocchio at the third stage that John Wood directed and Alan Lang wrote the music for. It wasn't a musical, but it had music in it. It was a very integral part of it. And Pinocchio, you know, you think of Pinocchio, Walt Disney, but the story is actually very dark. And we were just, you know, a bunch of actors on a bare stage with some pieces of silk and props and...
Like a minimalistic set? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, very, very kabuki style, and a lot of imagination. And it turned out to be like almost the hit of the festival that year. I mean, people went nuts for it because it's not just a story for kids. It's a story for grown-ups as well because there's a lot of morality in it and a lot of wonderful humor. So it was a great experience.
Michael, and I'll just remind our listeners, we're in the studio with Michael Burgess. Michael, show after show after show, performance after performance after performance, Are there nights or incidences or times that stand out because of a particular burned-in experience or maybe just a better gel with the crowd or an emotionalism that came with the whole evening? Do you know what I mean? Those sort of non-mechanical moments?
Well, you know, it's live theater, and you remember funny things that happened, things that weren't supposed to happen.
Yes.
Speaking of burned-in experiences, there was one night in Les Mis where my wig caught on fire. I shoot off the gun to make people think that I've actually killed Javert, and I haven't. I've just shot the gun, and I've let him go. I guess a spark from the gun came down and landed in my wig. So I was doing the thing. I turned around to look at the rest of the cast because the sound of this gun had woken them all up. They were sleeping as part of the action.
Yeah.
And they're all looking at me with their eyes like in terror. And I thought,
wow, they're really into this.
What's wrong? Is my fly open? You know, like, what's happening here? So, and they're all looking at my head. And then all of a sudden I start to smell it because it's just smoldering. So I thought, oh, great. Okay, this is one of those moments that you have to sort of put your wits together and just think about it for a second. So I just took my hand and just, you know, bashed myself on the head a couple of times and it went out. Just continued on and had a little laugh, and we all laughed about it later. But, you know, there's things like that.
That is too much.
Yeah, there's things. Those are the things that you remember. And in other ways... It's all an emotional experience in a way. You remember opening nights, you remember casts, colleagues that you've worked with, and funny things that happen. And they do because it's live. It's just like anything else. All the planning that you do, things don't work right sometimes, props.
Did you ever have an understudy want to pull a Tanya Harding on you and just kind of, you know, kneecap you so he can step in?
Well, I don't think so. But I'm sure some people have thought that.
Because those poor guys learn everything else that you know. They know it all. They're ready to step in. That's their whole role.
I know. And I often thought, you know, when you're doing it's one thing when you're doing a play for a couple of weeks or 3 or 4 weeks, you know, it goes by quickly. But when you're doing it for 3 years and some, you know, wonderfully talented person is just waiting there for an opportunity, and you're healthy as anything, and nothing happens, you know, doesn't get the opportunity. Yeah, it's hard. I have been an understudy myself, so...
You get it.
Yeah, I understand it, and You know, there have been situations where, you know, you actually plan the situation where you're going to be sick one night, and the person knows, and it's all done very carefully so that the audience doesn't get shortchanged in any
way. Sure, yeah. Spent a bit of time down in Manhattan. I saw a few performances. A friend of ours is Kathy Lee Gifford, and she put on a couple of tremendous musicals. One in particular I remember, Under the Bridge.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of that, that performance?
I have, yeah.
The book?
Yeah.
The gentleman, I wish I had my notes a little better on this, but the gentleman that played the main character in that, he put on a French accent and carried the whole play. He really did. He carried, not to take away from the rest of the actors, but just it carried it all.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel the pressure and the weight of carrying an entire performance?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That's a regular thing to feel, I guess.
Yeah, and I've always done, you know, for the most part, leading roles. And you're aware that you're out there more than some of the other people in the play. But mostly it was sort of afterwards. When you're in it, I mean, that's what I wanted. You know, like, you know, in hockey they say, you know, the guy wants the puck. I wanted the puck. Yeah. I wanted that.
You're the Paul Henderson of Les Mis.
Well, I don't know.
Got it.
That would be, that's quite a good comparison. But, yeah, no, so you want that. It's not an accident that you're there. You don't sort of start out thinking that that's what you want, but it's just an energy. I think that if I was doing something that where I wasn't really challenged, I'd just be bored. So.
Yeah. Well, look, one of the reasons you're here is because of your voice. The other reason you're here is because of who you are as a gentleman. You've come highly recommended by people I respect, and you're on your own unique spiritual journey, and that's what we want to talk about shortly.
Sure.
But before we get to that, Michael, I do want to hear your voice. I just want to hear your voice, and I sometimes I don't like admitting this because I like to come across as a bit of a tough guy, and I fail miserably at that.
time and time
again. Uh-huh. I was talking with Amy Grant about her show, Three Wishes, and I said to her, I was not appreciative of the fact that you made me cry on the couch all the time in front of my family, kind of a thing. With your singing, there is a melt factor. There's a penetration that comes with your style of singing. The tenor, I think, brings that with it. But the emotion, the professionalism, the talent, the gifting, I think there's a blessing attached with you without trying to sound too corny. I think there is.
That's been said to me before, and I've certainly been aware of it, and I totally accept the language and what it means. I think that there is too, and I've experienced it from an audience point of view. I've been at performances where I've just thought, this is a blessing, you know. This is a gift, and if people are moved that way because of what I do, I'm humbled in a way. But it's I've always felt since I've been doing this since I was a kid, I've always felt like a bit of an agent. I mean, I think talent only gives you the right to work hard.
Well said.
Because everybody has talent. I mean, talent is just all around us. All you have to do is look around. It's brilliant, brilliance everywhere. And so much of people's stories, people have different stories of what leads you to different places. And, you know, I know a lot of people who are in other professions who are brilliantly talented in musical ways who chose not to pursue that because they just didn't, parts of their personality just didn't resonate, and they felt more comfortable with other things. So I'm happy that people feel that way, and I guess, you know, one of the reasons that I'm drawn to certain roles has got to do with that. I seem to be drawn to roles that have big issues around them, big morality issues. I seem to understand them. You know, I was raised in a very kind of spiritual way. I went to St. Michael's Choir School for 10 years and was very influenced by that experience. I was in St. Augustine's Seminary. I was going to be a priest and decided that it wasn't for me.
You could have had a whole different shtick there, right? The singing priest.
No, that doesn't appeal to me.
I think someone's been there and done that already, right?
Yeah. But no, I, you know, it's it's just my story. That's what happened. And I have some wonderful friends. One priest who came to see Les Mis, and he came backstage afterwards, and really wonderful person. And he said, "You know what?" He said, "I think I'll just bring all my parishioners here on Sunday because this is a spiritual experience."
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Something similar when I was speaking with James Brown, and he had said something about this is very similar in many ways to doing church. We want to bring a lot of joy into people's lives, and there's a spiritual aspect to this.
Yeah.
And after being to one of his concerts, I thought, man, we just did church.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I'd rather do this kind of church than a lot of the other kind
than
of
the
church.
The normal church, yeah. Sometimes you feel that way. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing when that happens. It's amazing when life hits you like that, and it becomes a spiritual experience. I know that that when the producers and the creators of Les Miserables were putting it together in the middle 90s, they really didn't believe the audience would buy all the spiritual content and the God thing, and they tried to remove it. The more that they tried to remove it, the more they realized that this is the core of the story.
Such an integral part, you can't tamper with it.
They had to go with it. And, I don't think any musical has had the impact on every culture in the world, as Les Miserables. Mm. So, and for that reason, because it is at heart, it has a spiritual core.
Very interesting.
So, but, you know, so does life. And that's one of the brilliant things about it. I mean, you can tell. And you were talking about how hope is so important, and we get it from different things, and that's it with stories. Like for me, music tells stories. For me, music is extended speech. Singing is extended speech, and if I and even if it isn't in words, even if you're humming or if you're going do wa do and doing things, you're expressing an emotion.
Mm.
And and that's what people get. We've all been to performances, and I certainly have too, of where you know someone was very very good technically, but it just didn't
it lacked the
you.
Emotion, yeah. It lacked the depth,
yeah.
The sustenance,
yeah,
yeah,
and it just doesn't get you. It's the same as with an athlete, you know. You see great athletes, and everyone these days in the professional sports is brilliant. But some guys get you more than others. Some guys have a quality that is, for lack of a better term, spiritual.
Yeah.
You know, like and they do the same things. They run the same pass routes. They skate the same arenas.
But it's different.
But there's something different.
Yeah.
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 And you watch them more, and they get to you more. You know, so. It's hard to put into words. You know it when you see it, but you can't, there's no blueprint for it.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, yeah, well said. Michael Burgess joining us here on the Drew Marshall Show. Michael, I'd like you to sing. I'm begging you to sing.
Well, I think I'll sing something. I don't know why it just popped into my head. It's a little Irish tune.
Beautiful.
That I sang in a play a long, long time ago. And it's the play was Brendan Behan's The Hostage. So it's kind of this little lament. So I'll just sing a verse of it, if that's okay.
Please. Thank you.
'Twas on an August morning, all in the month of flowers, I went to take the warming air. All in the month of flowers, and there I saw a maiden, and heard her mournful cry. Oh, what will mend my broken heart? I've lost my laughing boy. So strong, so wide, so brave he was, I'll mourn his loss too sore. When thinking that we'll hear that laugh, or spring in step no more. Ah, curse the time, and sad the loss, my enemies to destroy. I'll praise your name and guard your fame, my own dear laughing boy.
Wow. You know, it's interesting, Michael, that you picked a little Irish thing to go there, because the Irish ditties, the Irish choruses have always penetrated me in a just a weird way. And I think it's because I have the Irish heritage in me. The eeriness of it,
yeah.
You know, the Celtic flavoring, yeah.
The bittersweet qualities.
Yeah. Beautiful stuff. The other thing that really gets me is when someone sings in another language. Why is that? Is it just because it's so new, or is it because of the different nuances of another language?
I think so. Yeah, I'm singing in other languages is a fascinating process, because you can't just do it by rote. You have to understand the nuance. You have to understand the idiom. You really have, and it's very hard when it's not a native language to you. I've been to operas where people are singing in three languages in the same opera because of replacements. So they have to call in someone at the last minute. Well, they know the opera, but they know it in another language.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And that's fine. They just bring them on in.
You know what? It's an amazing cultural thing when that happens. It works. It's not something you'd plan,
no.
and that you'd want to have a lot of risk in terms of financial things, but it works.
But it works because the non-communicational aspects of the song, the
emotional.
So if someone gets it in their own language, the emotion still comes across, so you still get it.
You still get it in another language. And my personal experience with a lot of that has to do with national anthems, because I've sung in seven languages at Canada Cups. And national anthems, you know, they are the most incredible things, because they inspire feelings. The minute you mention a national anthem, no matter what country you're from, something raises inside you.
Yeah.
The stakes are bigger.
Yeah.
You know, emotions come to the front. Whether they're mixed, pro, con, they're there.
It helps to ignite the passion, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it absolutely does. And I think that's one of the reasons why sports has adopted this format, you know, of the national anthem before the game, because there's a passion involved. Mm. The game is full of passion. The national anthem kind of prepares you for that passion. So it's an incredible experience. And having sung in a lot of different languages like that, you become very aware of the spiritual qualities and the feelings of people. And you don't know, you just can't predict what it's going to be like until you're standing there in front of 50,000 people and the announcer says, "Ladies and gentlemen, please rise." And
see, even those words get me.
You just don't know. And all of a sudden this
crescendo
feeling.
Yeah.
And it's feeling, it's palpable. You can feel it.
Yeah.
And, some of the most amazing experiences for me have been at international events where I've sung the anthem. And, you know, people aren't there to see you, but you're part of this passion.
You started off.
Yeah, that is very significant.
Sure.
So I've always wanted it to be like really great, just the greatest.
Yeah.
You know?
I remember we were in Australia for 5 years, and when we came back, in Australia, we didn't catch a lot of Leaf games. You know what I mean? And we came to back to Toronto, went to our first Leaf game, my son and I had, and first time at the ACC. We'd had seasons there with our family at the Gardens forever. Yeah. First time at the ACC, and here comes the national anthem. We stood, and I almost started bawling like a little kid.
There you go.
You know, I was just there again.
Yeah.
Well, it was tremendous. You've been on a few things in television here, and I'm looking at my notes, and Friday the 13th.
Oh, yeah, that was a blast.
Really?
That was a blast. I played a vampire, and... that was so much fun. I had a wonderful director, just a terrific director from New York, and had a great sense of humor. And of course, you know, we're dealing with a vampire story. It's a soap opera, you know, like, so all kinds of funny things happened. I had fangs fitted for my teeth, and when you're wearing fangs, you can't talk.
No.
I mean, it's funny. So a lot of it is done in post-sync. The dialogue is done in post, and when you're doing the actual scenes, you're doing the dialogue, and it's all full of emotion and everything else, but it's, you sound ridiculous. So there's a lot of laughter, and a lot of things made the Christmas reel. But all the television and film that I've done, I love film, and I love the medium. And in many ways, when I started really doing a lot of film and television, you know, the truth of what you're doing is the same, whether it's on stage to 4,000 people or 50,000 people or, you know, 10 people. The truth of what you're doing is the same in front of a camera. Mm. And I've always thought that theater has that quality in it in a very unique way. Because if you've got 3,000 people in the audience, you've got 3,000 cameras there. Because people are just like the camera. They can choose where they want to look. Mm. They can choose where their focus is going to be. And that's one of the wonderful difficulties, wonderful problems of the theater. You've got dimension. You've got layers. You've got a front. People are looking at the front. Other people who are raised up are looking in the middle. Other people who are up higher are looking at the back of the set, the back of the stage. And you've got all kinds of different stories going on at the same time. So people are taking all of this in. And, you know, like there were people that came to see Les Mis, for instance, you know, 15 times. And they would come on the 15th time, come backstage and go, "You've changed that scene." I go, "No, I haven't. Not at all. It's exactly the same as it's been doing." "No, I swear you've changed it. It's different." What it is that they didn't see it that way before.
Right.
They were sitting in a different location. They might have felt differently. They just saw something different. It's the same process that you have in a courtroom. You can have 12 people standing on the same street corner seeing the same incident, and you'll have 12 different versions of what happened.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty and the beautiful problem, one of the beautiful problems that you have in theater. And that's why, for me, film and theater have a real closeness about them. I don't, you know, there's certain technical things that you need to stand on a stage and fill a hall of, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 people. But I think more than anything, you need commitment. It isn't about projecting your voice or doing anything like that. It's an internal commitment that you need. I think that, and I've seen it happen with great actors, I think you could whisper on a stage in front of 3,000 people and everybody will lean their ears until they'll hear you.
Yeah.
It's just like those Disney movies where, you know, something happens in the forest and all of a sudden every animal within 50 miles pops their head up.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I find the difference between the artists who are aware and who are unaware primarily has to do with the fact that they're secure enough to make the audience lean in, as opposed to always rushing out and meeting the audience.
Yeah.
It's the insecure artists that always feel that they have to be in the audience's face on every syllable and every breath and every little nuance.
Yeah.
And you just say, just relax.
You want to
let
invite them.
Yes.
In.
Yeah.
And they have a job to do too, which is to listen, which is to be engaged. So it works both ways, yeah.
Well, I want to take a short break here, folks, to give you a chance to go get a coffee or take a break, and we're going to be right back.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Alors je n'ai plus de doute, l'amour existe encore, toutes mes années de déroute, toutes je les donnerai toutes, pour manquer à ton port, la solitude que je redoute, qui me guette au bout de ma route. Je la mettrai dehors pour t'aimer une fois pour toutes, pour t'aimer coûte que coûte, malgré ce mal qui court, aimer l'amour, amour, quand je m'endors contre toi.
Well, folks, we are in the studio with Michael Burgess. tremendous talent, tremendous blessing, tremendous responsibility carrying this gift around, and he has used it. Well, to be quite honest, I think he's actually used it to the glory of God. Maybe more later in his life than earlier, but maybe unknowingly he's penetrated people's hearts on behalf of the Creator with this incredible gift he has. Anyway, Michael joins us here on the show today, and Michael, before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about your spiritual journey and where things have come and gone with all of that.
Uh-huh.
How comfortable are you talking about your spiritual life? Because for many, it's a very private thing. Very private thing.
It is private. I certainly respect that with people. I'm not uncomfortable talking about it. It's part of me. It is a journey. It started when I could first, you know, talk and figure out what the heck's going on here and what are we doing here, you know. And a lot of questions. You're always asking questions. I always ask a lot of questions, like, what does that mean? And why does this happen? And why do you do that? You know, it's
so you've always been a seeker.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, sure. And I was brought up as a Catholic, which, you know, you don't choose who your parents are. You choose who you're born and where you're born into. And I kind of think, you know, that we're kind of baptized atheists, you know, like, you have to come to it on your own terms. Mm. It doesn't matter
what you're born into.
No, whether you're a Muslim or whether you're Catholic, or you have to somehow come to it in a journey. You have to come, and it never stops. You come to it on your own terms. So, as I was talking earlier about commitment, you also need to make commitment in your spiritual life. It is ultimately about commitment. That commitment can change and alter and take different routes sometimes, because that's the nature of who we are. We change. And thank goodness, because in many ways we are all about change. And hopefully it's about change for the better. It's about becoming more tolerant, becoming more gracious with people, becoming more understanding, becoming more loving, coming to a point where so many of the things that you think are important ultimately aren't. Mm. That people just need to be supported, cared for, and some of the things that the world leads us to think are important are not. You know, they're just not. It's all about in many ways loving people and loving yourself. And finding a place where that's comfortable, and something that leads you to God. And I think that's inevitable. When you're on that journey, you do come clashing right into God.
Yeah, and the way you verbalize that, I mean, you certainly captured the essence of the New Testament, where everything it needs to be about love. God is love. And the greatest commandment is love.
Yeah, sometimes we don't feel that.
No.
You know,
no.
It's hard. On a daily basis, we get tested, we get pushed around, we get a lot of things to make us think. You know, and that's really the crucial part, making us think. You know, it's like your mother always told you, if you don't have something nice to say about somebody, don't say it.
Yeah.
You know, and think twice before jumping in and speaking. Those are good things, and learning to accept other people's points of view, no matter how radically they differ from yours. Mm. That's a crucial thing, and I think that if you know, as kids, I think that's where it happens. If you can raise kids, if you can encourage kids to just be accepting of the differences of other people's points of view. And in some ways, in a lot of times, you find out the viewpoints are very similar. They're just used in different, they're expressed in different languages, different ways, different idioms.
Mm. Spiritual disciplines, because you said, you know, it really comes down to decision and choice and commitment. That was the word you used,
yeah.
Commitment. But with that commitment, you've chosen to be part of the entertainment uh-huh. industry, and there is a massive level of commitment there. You've also chosen to say, you know, I believe Jesus is who he said he was.
Uh-huh.
But along with that, there's a level of commitment, because there are things in this world that want to tear down that belief.
Yeah.
And so what sort of spiritual disciplines have you been able to kind of hunker down in life? Let me just admit something, first of all. My prayer life is horrible, weak, pathetic, selfish. My daily times spent in God's Word is quite often pushed aside by daily life. So that's pathetic as well. So I'm admitting what a schmuck I am before I ask you what kind of a schmuck you are.
I'm a very similar schmuck. You know, that's the wonder of it all. We're trying. You keep trying.
Yeah.
I mean, I was raised, as I said at St. Mike's, I sang Mass every morning at 7 o'clock. And I had a wonderful experience actually two nights ago. I was part of a tribute for Dominic Troiano, the great guitarist, and down at Joe Badali's. And I had met Dominic many, many times. I work with a lot of musicians who knew him very well. Doug Riley is my pianist. And Dominic was he fought cancer for many, many years. And you know, when you met Dominic, it was very spiritual. I mean, he was a very cool dude, but he had a wonderful deep quality, and he wanted people to get in touch with their own voice and be true to themselves. And David McMorrow was there. David and I grew up together as kids at St. Mike's, and David's a brilliant musician, a terrific person. He's fought a lot of demons too, as we all have. And David, because it was a tribute to Dominic, who passed away a short time ago, he phoned me like the day of it, and he said, "You know, I just want to go over the words to In Paradisum, which is a song for the dead, part of the liturgy of the Requiem Mass." And I know it from memory, because we did it so many times.
Sure.
So he was a couple of phrases he wasn't sure about. So I told him what they were. And then he said, "Great, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Michael." And so he called me back 5 minutes later. He said, "Look, why don't you sing this with me?" He said, "I was just thinking about our childhood, and I was just thinking about Monsignor Ronan and mornings at 7 o'clock and all those masses that we did and all the spiritual upbringing that we had." And said, "Would you sing it with me?" I said, "No question. Yeah, I would love to." Mm. So down there, you know, when we did it, I mean, it's a bar, you know, and it's a big celebration. But it was really a wonderful moment. Mm. It wasn't about anything except just connecting with David and I and sharing a background.
Mm. Spiritual origins.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So there's lots of different ways. Basically, you try and be a good person. You try and not be untrue to those things that you believe in. And given the opportunity to not be untrue, I think you become stronger and you become more willing to speak out about it. Mm. You can't shove things down people's throat. That's for sure.
Mm. A good friend told me no one wants to be sold.
Yeah.
But everybody wants to buy something.
Everybody wants an example,
yeah.
I believe. And
yeah.
I think, you know, in sports, and you know Paul, I know Paul Henderson, he's a terrific, terrific individual and a great friend. And, you know, it's one of the great things of sports that leaders lead by example. They know when to say something, and they know when to pull somebody in and say, "Look, you know, got to have a talk here." But basically, the most powerful way to lead is lead by example.
Mm.
So that is where you try and be. You try and lead by example in the way you live, the way you interact with people, and the way you treat people, and the causes that you espouse and the things you speak up for. So I think that's where the power really
yes.
is.
Michael, in many people's lives, the hurt or the pain that we experience causes us to either run from the Creator, you know, get angry at God, or run to Him. C.S. Lewis, one of his famous quotes is, "Pain is God's megaphone to a deaf world."
Uh-huh.
And
how true is that?
Yeah, very much so. And things in your life, tough stuff you've gone through, and how you handled that spiritually. Can you relate anything like that at all to us or for us?
Sure. Yeah, there's been lots of times when, you know, I felt despair. I felt kind of deserted, wondering if maybe this was wrong all along,
if what was wrong?
You know,
the Jesus stuff?
Yeah, that God is good and God is going to look after it. I mean, you look around, things happen and things are awful sometimes. There's a lot of pain and destruction and you think, it's hard to see God in the world sometimes.
Yeah. Where are you?
Yeah. But I think often when you find it to be its strongest is in the worst times you could possibly feel. I think it's a blessing for bad things to happen sometimes. You don't see it that way, but we've always been raised with that notion that out of bad things, good things happen. Sometimes it seems trite and meaningless. Nice thought, but please spare me, you know. But that's true. That's what happens when human beings are put to the test. I think that they reach down, they do find that they come face to face with God, and they do find that their faith is... They find a part of their faith that they didn't even know they had, and that's the strength. And, you know, Jesus was the one that said there's more joy in heaven over a person who is sorry for having sinned than the one who never sinned at all.
Yep.
I think the things that happen to us to make us strong,
right.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
If we make the choices, we can be stronger out of them. You know, going through a divorce is very hard. You feel like a failure. You feel... that you can't overcome things, you feel lost, many things, and you pray. When things get tough, you pray, and I think that's why we have prayer. I mean, and people say, well, yeah, but why don't you pray when things are okay? Well, I do, but I think we pray a little harder when things are tough, because all of a sudden, the black and white aspects of it get really black and white. We see it better. And you gotta have friends. You gotta have friends that you can call on when things get really difficult. And you gotta be able to laugh. I think more than anything else, you've gotta be able to laugh.
Yeah.
I think God is a God of humor. I think that He's had a big laugh since time began.
Oh yeah. You know, one of the main reasons I'm convinced that God has a sense of humor is that I was a high school dropout and never got along with any teachers, and especially vice principals. Never got along with them at all. And I ended up pastoring in a church in Australia that had 30 teachers in the church.
Yeah.
See, that's a sense of humor right there.
That's right. It'll come back on you.
There's something wrong with that one, let me tell you. Well, you're just a huge sports fiend.
Yeah.
Is that how your connection with the ranch, with Teen Ranch? How did you first get involved with Mel and the gang at the ranch? Was it through the hockey guys?
Yeah, through Paul.
Through Henny?
And, Bruce Bowser and other people. And, Mel is just a very special person, as you know. And he's been, doing great things out there for so many years. There's nothing that I wouldn't do to help him out because of the great work he does.
Yeah. He is a tremendous gentleman for sure, and what a great place. That place has saved my life on more than one occasion.
And many other people's,
Singing at the World Series in 92 in Atlanta, Toronto 1993, two Canada Cups in six languages, the NHL All-Star Game in Madison Square Garden, and the anthems at the final game at Maple Leaf Gardens?
Yeah.
Man!
Yeah, that was a rush. That was great. I grew up, going to see St. Mike's and the Marlies. After I'd sing at St. Michael's Cathedral and go and have breakfast and then go to the games at the Gardens and seeing the Leafs. I've always been a Leaf fan, and having the opportunity to sing for them has been absolutely wonderful. I was the first person to ever sing O Canada at a Toronto Maple Leaf home game, which is it's hard to believe because Harold Ballard simply would never allow anybody to do it. He just wouldn't. So when Harold passed away, Bob Stellick, one of the first calls he made was to me. He said, "Michael, come on down here." Now the sound system.
So you were the first and the last.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I was, and
what an honor.
The sound system at the Gardens in the beginning was just horrendous.
Horrible.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
It had never been used.
Well, it was meant for the guy up in the booth who never even watched the game. He just read his papers during the game and got, what was his name? Do you remember?
Toronto goal scored by number 32.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I can't remember
that's
the
good.
Guy's name.
But they gave me the Leaf organization phoned me and said, look, well, they gave me the choice of singing the final game at the Gardens or opening up the Air Canada Centre. I said, no brainer.
Oh, hello.
I'll be at Maple Leaf Gardens.
Sure.
You know, there's tradition there, and that'll never happen again. But the Air Canada Centre will be there for a while. So
Mikhail Gorbachev and the Queen.
Yeah, Gorbachev was really wonderful, very graceful, elegant man. And it was a pleasure to be able to perform for him. And the Queen, I've had the great pleasure of performing for on a number of occasions, both on Parliament Hill and just this past summer out in Saskatchewan. I was born in Regina, so the centenary of Saskatchewan, she came to visit. And it's always a pleasure. She's a very gracious and wonderful, wonderful human being to meet. But the big thing for me that I was standing on stage with Joni Mitchell and got to do my bows with Joni Mitchell right there, and that was amazing.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
Who have you not met that you'd like to meet? And someone in the entertainment industry, or a politician, or a great person in our lifetime?
There's lots of people. I wish I had met Gandhi. I wish I had met and had a conversation with Pope John. There's many, many people, great people that I would love to meet. And I, you know, just like anybody else, I'm sure we all sit down and have conversations in our mind with, what would it go like? You know,
yeah.
Like, yeah, I'd like to ask you about that. Yeah. And, yeah, oh, yeah, did you see the Laugh Leaf game? You
know? Yeah, yeah.
It's too bad they didn't make the playoffs this year. You know, all of those things. You just want to have conversations with them and talk about things that matter.
Yeah. Speaking of things that matter, Pat Quinn.
Yeah.
You okay with him being fired? That was a deep breath, Michael.
Yeah, I like Pat a lot. I've gotten to know him. He's a terrific guy. He's a great hockey person. I guess, you know that it's going to happen. Those kinds of changes happen in sports. It's not that I'm not okay with it, but it has to be.
It's part of the mechanism.
And Pat, I think Pat's going to be in hockey in a very significant way.
Sure. He'll land on his feet.
Yeah. No, there's no question about that. He's got so much still to offer.
Right. What about the GM?
The GM, you know, that's a political situation. John Ferguson, what a great history he has with his dad and his hockey knowledge. And, you know, time will tell. We'll see. There's a lot of different feelings that you're reading in the pages in the sports pages these days. The writers have a lot of very strong feelings about it, and that's what makes the world go round. You know, everyone's got a different take on it,
sure.
And John Ferguson's the guy that's sitting there on the hot seat, and it's up to him. And you know, if that's how he feels the Leafs are going to be a better team. Then he's got to go with it, and he's got to take the heat, and he's got to deal with it. So we'll see. I want the Leafs to win a Stanley Cup before too long, I think everybody else in Toronto does too.
Can you imagine? I want you to imagine this, okay? You ready? Let's say seventh game, Stanley Cup Finals, Leafs are in it. Maybe they're even playing Montreal. Let's just add it, you know, a little crescendo to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And out comes on the ice Michael Burgess to sing O Canada.
That would be where I'd want to be. That's
man,
where I'd want to be. You know, I was involved singing in all those games in 92, 93. They were just phenomenal.
Yeah.
They were just amazing to be at. I mean, you couldn't. It was just one big din from beginning to end. Yeah.
Taking us out. I know we've talked about a couple of different
yeah.
options here, but I would love for you to sing a chorus and a verse, or a verse and a chorus, depending on how you want to start into it, of You Raise Me Up.
I first heard it when I was driving along in my car, and this song just struck me, so I pulled over to the side of the road and listened to it, and then Josh Groban recorded it, and
Josh Groban, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and I've been singing it ever since. So,
right.
Yeah.
All right, folks, we're going to go out with Michael Burgess singing "You Raise Me Up" here on the show. And,
how does it start?
I don't have a clue. Yeah, Michael, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Drew. A great pleasure.
Yeah.
When I am down, and oh, my soul so weary, when troubles come, and my heart burdened be, I am still, wait here in the silence, until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. And I am strong when I am on your shoulders. You raise me up to more than I can be.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
That carry me away from you.